MacCast, Sunday, February 3rd, 2019. Hey, MacGeeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for MacGeeks by MacGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, another week has gone by, another week of Apple Mac news, rumors, and other things to get into. Actually, this week is pretty big because we have Apple's quarterly results call to dive into, and yeah, it came out pretty good, despite Apple doing a little rejiggering in their guidance, and we'll get into those numbers and let you know how things turned out. We're also going to talk a little bit about a group FaceTime bug that Apple is having to deal with, and wasn't a very good one for a company who's very focused on privacy to have to deal with this past week. And we're going to talk about Apple's video service and when that might be coming out. We've got more rumors related to that. Also, rumors and updates on the next generation of iPads. We've been talking about those for the past few weeks now. Google and Facebook had a little bit of issues with the App Store. We'll get into details on that and then finish up the news with some information about Apple changing things up in their Siri group. And then we'll get into some of your feedback. We're going to have another augmented reality app recommendation this week. Actually, a really good one, an app that I've been using for a while. We're going to follow up on Apple's trade-in program and share some more of your experiences with that. We're going to talk a little bit more about Wi-Fi passwords and why they keep popping up back on your Mac, even though you think they may have been erased and removed. And then finally, we're going to follow up a little bit more on our discussion about Apple TV and gaming. There's actually some more information out this week kind of related to that. So we'll dive into that. And that should round out the show for this week. But before we dive in, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Hair Club. Hey, you know what? Your confidence is important, and sometimes one change can make all the difference. Hair Club knows this, and they're inviting you to become part of the Hair Club family to see how getting the most out of your hair can change your life. They understand the emotions that you're feeling and know the questions that you have. Hair Club is the leader in total hair solutions with a legacy of success for over 40 years. Whether you're looking to revitalize the growth of your own hair or to learn more about the latest proven methods for hair replacement or hair restoration, Hair Club's professionally trained stylists, hair health experts, and consultants will craft a personalized solution to ensure you feel your best and get the most out of your hair. See for yourself just how powerful hair can be. You know, so far, I'm lucky. I don't suffer from hair loss, but my dad did, and I remember him doing crazy stuff like standing on his head in the hopes that blood flow would return to his scalp and that would somehow help. With Hair Club, he wouldn't have had to rely on crazy solutions like that. He could use real, proven solutions with the help of Hair Club. So go to hairclub.com/MacCast today for a free hair analysis and a free take-home hair kit, all valued at over $300. That's hairclub.com/MacCast for a free hair analysis and free hair kit. hairclub.com/MacCast, and a big thank you to them for their support of the show. So Apple announced their Q1 2019 results, and right in line with their revised guidance, they did have revenue performance fall just a little bit, coming in at $83.4 billion with $19.7 billion in profits for the holiday quarter. Originally, Apple had estimated that they would bring in between $89 to $93 billion, but they did revise that estimate down earlier in the month, saying that they would come in around $83 billion, so they were right on target there. Revenue was down about $4 billion from the same quarter a year ago, but profit was almost at the $20.1 billion that they reported last year. Apple said iPhone revenue was down 15% from the prior year, but that total revenue from all products and services grew about 19%. They also said that Mac revenue was up 9%. Home, wearables, and accessories were up an amazing 33%, with about 50% growth in wearables alone, and iPad revenue was up 17%. So that's great news, because iPads had been declining for a while, so it's nice to see a little bounce back there. As a matter of fact, also, services revenue reached an all-time high of about $10.9 billion. That's the first time it moved into the double-digit territory, and we do know that Apple has been seeing pretty significant services growth over the past few quarters. Even with lowered guidance and the drop in iPhone revenue, the quarter was Apple's second best in history in terms of revenue and profit, so still pretty darn good by any stretch of the imagination. This is the first quarter, though, where Apple is no longer breaking down unit sales figures by product line, so that leaves analysts and investors to sort of, back into those numbers and try and figure them out. And of course, they're already starting to do that. Strategy Analytics took a guess at breaking out the numbers, and this is how they predicted it played out. They think that Apple shipped about 65.9 million iPhones in the quarter, and they say that was down from 77.3 million that they shipped in the same period last year. A couple of other items of note from the call. 1.4 billion active Apple devices are now in the market, and Apple says 900 million of those are iPhones, so that's a nice, healthy place to sell services into, I would think. Nice little starting point. Apple Music now has about 50 million paid subscribers. That's actually up from 40 million just about 6 months ago, so Apple getting pretty good subscriber growth in terms of Apple Music. Just as a side note, another little story that came out related to Apple Music this week. Subscribers to Apple Music are going to be able to listen to Apple Music for free on American Airlines flights without having to pay for extra Wi-Fi access. So that's a nice little perk you're going to get. Getting back to the quarterly results, Apple News now has over 85 million monthly active users. I had no idea there were that many people using Apple News, and I think I threw this out to the community a while back. I'm not a huge Apple News reader, but I do pop into the app every once in a while to check things out. I still rely mainly on RSS feeds, but I did hear from many of you that you are really enjoying Apple News, and that, again, subscriber base should help Apple expand their services revenue if they eventually roll out, as we think they are, a version of their Texture magazine subscription service inside Apple News. Apple says they did about 1.8 billion Apple Pay transactions over the holiday quarter. That's quite impressive. And again, that's another thing that brings in a little bit of services revenue. They say they now have over 360 million paid subscriptions across the App Store, and that is an increase from 120 million just a year ago. So what is that? That's like triple growth. And then finally, Apple says they are on track to double their 2016 services revenue by 2020. So as you can tell in this quarterly results call, a pretty heavy focus there on Apple services growth, and it kind of gives us an indication on where they're heading for the next few quarters and really what they're expecting to sort of offset those slowing iPhone sales. Apple did also address iPhone pricing, saying that they are rethinking how they price iPhones, especially in the international markets. They are no longer going to track the US dollar price exactly and adjust for different local currency prices. They are going to start pricing iPhone in specific markets based on other economic factors, this should be good news for international Apple fans, especially in those markets that tend to trend weaker against the dollar. It's obviously going to impact Apple's bottom line, though, since they will be reducing the average selling price and cutting into their margins. So we're going to have to see how that plays out. I'm thinking that Apple is hoping it means they'll sell more iPhones in those markets and they'll make up the differences in the volume. Apple's Tim Cook also did lay out a four-part strategy for how Apple plans to leverage their upcoming video streaming service in 2019. No, he didn't confirm that video streaming service beyond what they've already done, which is confirm that they are working on original video content, but he was asked about it during the Q&A, and he said Apple is looking to leverage Apple TV hardware as their streaming platform, that they are looking to AirPlay 2 to help expand upon that, and we do know from the news last week that, or over the last couple weeks, that Apple plans to integrate AirPlay 2 into upcoming television sets from manufacturers like Samsung and Vizio. They also say they are going to leverage the growth of third-party subscription services, so other original programming and TV content from places like HBO and Netflix. And finally, he did again confirm and mention that Apple is producing their own first-party original programming as part of that plan. So overall, I have to say it's a pretty good quarter for Apple. Again, despite the fact that we do know iPhone sales are down, I think it is really significant that this is Apple's second best quarter ever. I mean, this is not a bad quarter. Despite what it might have looked like going into it, I think Apple did overall very well. It's looking like they have definitely a plan moving forward, and it'll be interesting to see how they continue to execute on that plan. Again, we're expecting big things in the first part of spring in terms of some new announcements, so that should help out again in the second quarter. And so overall, I just think, you know, this was a pretty positive results call. Apple did hit a pretty big bump in the road this week for a company who is strongly focused on security and privacy. They had to shut down their group FaceTime feature. The reason, there was a bug that could allow a caller to both hear and possibly see a person who had been invited to but had not yet joined a group FaceTime call. The way it worked is you would initiate a FaceTime call with someone, and then while that call was still connecting or ringing, if you swiped up from the bottom of the display and then tapped the option to add a person to that call and then entered your own phone number, it would add that person to the call automatically and put you in it as well. So the connection would be made and both parties would be on that call. Unfortunately, the person on the other end who hadn't really picked up wouldn't know it, because on the on-screen display, it would look like they were still being contacted. So at that point, what would be happening is you would just be hearing the audio from that person's side. But if they did actually reach up and tap the side button, the sleep-wake button, maybe in an attempt to dismiss the call, which is normally what would happen, what would actually happen is then the video would start and connect as well. So this is obviously, or was obviously, a huge bug with big security ramifications. Apple did quickly shut down the service so that they could work on a patch, and that is expected soon, but supposedly, there is some debate on how quickly Apple had responded to this. There was a mother who had attempted to notify Apple about the bug about a week before it was made public on social media and Reddit areas. Apple did come out with statements to sources like Mac Rumors and thanked the woman for actually reporting the bug, but it did seem like it took them a little bit longer than it should have for them to come public. Now, all said and done, Apple did address the issue fairly quickly, and Mac Rumors says that they told them they plan to re-enable the group FaceTime feature sometime next week or in this coming week when they officially issue a patch in the software for the problem. So overall, you know, a pretty big bug, something that could have gone very, very badly for Apple. Luckily, it was identified and it looks like it was addressed relatively quickly. Of course, we're already hearing about some potential class action lawsuits, and there was one at least one account where some information may have been exposed in a legal capacity where it shouldn't have been by this bug. So that's a pretty big deal. Again, we're probably going to hear more reports of this now that this has been made public, and it definitely was a big slip up for Apple, but it doesn't really look like it was anything that was intentional or that they were trying to do to allow, you know, people to do eavesdropping. And it certainly wasn't a hack. It simply looks like it was just a big bug in the software. Apple CEO Tim Cook was asked about their upcoming video service during their quarterly results call. Of course, he did not let on to too many details, and something we've all been wondering about is when is Apple going to be actually rolling out the service? There's been some suspicion that it would be sometime this spring, but we haven't had a lot of hard evidence to confirm that. Well, this week that changed a little bit. Apple is reportedly telling partners to be ready in mid-April for an impending launch a few weeks later. This is according to information from the source or the publication called The Information. One of the things that's been rumored as far as how Apple will make revenue from the service is through selling third-party or access to third-party subscription services like HBO and Stars, so those premium services. And they are reportedly telling those partners, hey, get ready, the service is coming, you need to have your stuff ready to go. And the belief is that everything is going to be rolled inside Apple's TV app. So essentially, you would have one single app, Apple's built-in TV app, and no longer need to install any of the third-party apps to actually get that premium content. It would all be rolled into that single application. I'm not really sure at this point how browsing would work, because right now it is a very different experience. Anybody who is using the TV app knows it kind of aggregates what you've been watching and you can search and things like that, but just browsing content from the various service providers usually means being handed off to their third-party app. I was kind of thinking about this a little bit, and I thought, well, maybe the apps would be handled like apps in Messages, where you kind of have this little subset of the app that exists inside the parent app. That could be an interesting experience. I have to tell you, overall, I love the TV app. It is my number one source to go to for finding content. And right now it's basically just mostly the recommendations and searching. And so I would love to see that expanded into the ability to actually be able to browse through some of my other premium content. I do subscribe to HBO. I am now a Hulu subscriber and I'm enjoying a lot of that content. But again, I'm finding I'm having to jump off to the other app and it is a little bit of a fragmented experience. So if Apple can work with their partners to kind of roll that stuff together and create a better experience, I think that actually could be really huge and it could make that new video streaming service very compelling. I like this whole idea of Apple doing this and then roll in their new original content shows that we've been hearing a lot about, some stuff that sounds really amazing. They've got stuff in comedy and sci-fi and drama stuff, also original documentaries. I know they're working with Oprah. That was another thing that Tim Cook mentioned during the quarterly results call. And I think this service could be huge. I think it could be very, very popular, especially if really, we hear this plan that Apple is going to make that original content available to anybody that has an iOS device. Remember, that's 1.4 billion devices out there, and that's going to bring a lot of eyeballs, and it's going to be very hard for some of these premium services who've sort of stayed away or shied away from what Apple is doing, and we're looking right at you, Netflix, to actually stay out of this whole deal. And I think that's ultimately very good for Apple. It's going to be ultimately likely very good for their continued services growth. And again, definitely seems to be a direction that they're moving in. So I'm getting very excited about the upcoming video service. I'd love to know what you think. Do you think this is a good direction for Apple to move in? I had originally been a little bit afraid of it. If you go back and listen to MacCast episodes from probably about 5 to 6 years ago, I did worry about them getting into video production and maybe becoming sort of like Sony, where they were originally focused on consumer electronics and then expanded in too big a way. You know, Sony started buying Sony Picture Studios and getting into movie production and all those sorts of things. I don't think Apple's moving in on that scale, so I think maybe they can manage it a little bit better, but you might counter-argue that. If you look at what's been happening with Mac rollouts and maybe the operating system and stuff like that, you could make an argument that maybe Apple is going off in too many directions and losing focus from their core business. I think they're kind of managing it okay for now, but I'm always a little bit cautious about keeping an eye on that. Overall, I'm pretty happy with Apple's hardware efforts to date, and I think it does make sense to just slow things, the pace of things out on that front, just based on consumer buying behavior, which also seems to have slowed down. So overall, I think this is a good strategy. I'm excited about the video service, but I'd love to know what you think. Shoot me some feedback, send me some emails, maccast@gmail.com. A couple new pieces of hardware that we are expecting from Apple in the coming months are a couple of new iPads, the sixth generation of the iPad 9.7-inch, and an updated fifth-generation iPad mini. I know, we got an iPad mini coming. We've been talking about that the last few weeks. Of course, we're all wondering what that is going to look like. What are the features going to be in there? We've talked about a few of those. This week, we have a few more details. Developer Steve Troughton-Smith has continued to dig into the latest betas of iOS 12 and found a few other interesting tidbits that we haven't talked about. He did notice references that seem to indicate that both those new devices, the sixth generation iPad and the fifth generation iPad mini, could have support for the Apple Pencil. I think that makes a lot of sense. Apple has put some significant focus, and I would assume that's the second generation Apple Pencil. But more interestingly, he's also saying that they both could support the Smart Keyboard. I think that makes sense for the 9.7-inch model. I think it might get a little cramped or a little bit weird with the iPad mini. I don't know how you would pull that off. I already find that my Smart Keyboard on my 11-inch iPad Pro is a little cramped, especially compared to the 12.9-inch model. So we'll have to wait and see. Of course, you know, Apple does have a Smart Keyboard cover for the 9.7-inch, so I don't think that's too big a stretch, but that's some good news. Apple Pencil support, keyboard support in the new updates, which we are expecting to happen sometime this spring. They're also expected to have Touch ID support. That would be to keep costs down, so don't expect them to have Face ID or the True Depth camera system. And as far as how they're going to get produced, well, DigiTimes is reporting that Taiwanese manufacturer Compal Electronics could potentially be a manufacturing partner for the iPad Mini 5. The other interesting thing to note in this rumor about Compal is the piece does say that they are planning to start that production, quote, later this year. I don't think that necessarily means that we're not going to see the new iPad updates in the first quarter. In the past, historically, though, Apple has rolled out new iPad updates in the fall, like the September timeframe, but I do think that that could get stepped up as Apple tries to keep up iPad demand, and it just feels like the timing is right because we got iPad Pro announcements in the fall, and to follow up with a spring announcement of the more consumer-focused, little less expensive models seems to make sense for me. So I am still thinking we're going to see a April-May launch of these updated versions of the iPads. We also got a few rumors related to the next generations of the iPhone, and more significantly, a few rumors about what we might expect in iOS 13, and these are coming out of Bloomberg. A lot of the stuff that they are saying backs up some of the earlier reports we've been hearing about the next generation of iPhone, specifically that they are expecting a triple lens camera system coming to the updated version of the Plus model, and that will be followed up in 2020 by a new rear camera system that uses lasers for time of flight depth perception for applications like augmented reality. They're also backing up the rumors that Apple will likely move from the Lightning connector on the iPhone to USB-C connectors, I'm assuming Thunderbolt, in 2019. And then finally, they talk a little bit about updates to the next generation of iOS, saying that Apple is planning on releasing a new dark mode for iOS in iOS 13, and that there will be a few new iPad-specific enhancements to the home screen and improved file management. I don't know if the improved file management also means that we're going to get a revamp of Apple's Files application or if that will be expanded out in terms of functionality, but Apple could do some very interesting things there. It would be also great if with iOS, although this wasn't part of the rumor, but I know a lot of people would like this, if Apple finally started supporting, and I think they could do this with USB-C, finally started supporting external storage devices like hard drives, flash drives, and those sorts of things. Many of you have been asking for those features for years, and as Apple positions the iPad more and more as a laptop alternative or laptop replacement, I think it only makes sense for that kind of functionality to come into play. So I'm going to read that into the fact that Apple is looking at improved file management. Whether or not that turns out to be a reality remains to be seen, but I do think it would be the right direction to move in. And I know a lot of folks out there really like dark mode. Certainly isn't my thing. I don't use it on macOS. I'm not a big fan of it in most of my applications. But again, I know it's very popular and a lot of people really like it. So that's probably good news for a lot of you as well. Employees at both Google and Facebook this week had their internal iOS apps blocked by Apple. This is because Apple revoked the enterprise developer certificates for both companies after they discovered that they were using those certificates in ways that violated Apple's policies, specifically to distribute apps to consumers and not employees of the company. Both companies had a couple of applications that were used to track consumer behavior, and those were being sideloaded basically outside the App Store, given directly to consumers, and that Apple says is a direct violation of their policies when it comes to enterprise certificates. Enterprise certificates are specifically intended to be used for internal apps at companies and exclusively for employee use. Apple discovered that both Google and Facebook were using their certificates to distribute those apps to the general public, and they revoked those certificates, shutting them down. Since 2016, Facebook had been paying teens and adults about $20 a month to install a data gathering app called Facebook Research. The Google app was an app called ScreenWise Meter that did something similar in terms of tracking household web access and usage. So basically, analytics, data gathering applications that were, again, being handed out to consumers using these enterprise certificates. So when Apple found out about this, of course, they shut it down by revoking those certificates. The unfortunate side effect of that, though, is it doesn't just disable those applications. It also disables any other applications that were signed with those certificates. And of course, these companies, because they have these certificates, do have additional apps that are used by employees, used in the way that the certificates were intended to be used, and it did impact that. So needless to say, they were not happy about Apple revoking those certificates. They worked quickly with Apple to get those apps reinstated and those certificates reinstated and restored. And all is well now. It was just about a day of disruption or so. So hopefully it didn't impact employees too badly. I'm sure some of you might have worked for some of those companies and had maybe been impacted. If you have, and you have an opinion that you can share with us, shoot us some feedback. Send us an email, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally in the news for this week, a little bit of Siri news. Apple is maybe restructuring how the Siri division is working. This, again, comes from the information they are reporting that Apple's Siri team lead, Bob Stasier, has stepped down from his role in response to an overall switch in the product strategy. They note that he is still at the company. He hasn't left, but they don't know in what capacity or what his current title is. According to the rumor, the change in leadership is part of a restructuring effort by Vice President John Giandrea, who is planning to focus more on long-term research with Siri versus incremental updates and improvements. I'm not so sure how I feel about this, given the current state of Siri. Siri has been kind of on a roll lately. We've been talking about this here on the MacCast for a while. You know, Siri is generally seen as being a little bit further behind some of the other smart assistants like Amazon Echo and Google Home, and Apple's been playing a little bit catch up. And over the recent years and months, I've found Siri to become better and better. And I have a feeling that has a lot to do with these incremental kinds of updates. Of course, I'd love to see big, larger sweeping features and more functionality coming. That's good too, but I don't think that one should happen as a consequence of the other. So I hope that's not what's going on here, but that seems to be what this restructuring is intended to do, at least according to the rumors. I'm sure there's a lot more to it. A lot of times we just get little bits and pieces out here on the front lines, but overall I hope that the Siri improvements continue as they have been. But only time will tell. We're going to have to wait and see on this one. But again, with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another couple show sponsors, starting with Upstart. You know, applying for a loan is a lot like applying for a job that you don't get to interview for. Instead, loan companies make their decisions based off your credit score and history without really getting to know the whole you. Well, now, thanks to Upstart.com, it never has to be that way again. Upstart is revolutionizing the way you borrow money by rewarding you for your job experience and education in the form of a smarter interest rate. Coming out of college, you know, I hadn't made a lot of wise financial decisions. I don't think a lot of us do. I had racked up a lot of credit card debt, and it took me like years to pay that off. I would love to have the opportunity to try a service like Upstart. I think I probably could have paid off my debt a lot sooner and potentially paid out a lot less in interest. What makes Upstart different is, unlike traditional credit underwriting, which could be biased against people with short credit histories, they go beyond the traditional FICO score when assessing your credit worthiness. Upstart believes that you are more than just your credit score. They make it fast, simple, and easy to check your rates in less than 2 minutes without affecting your credit score. And the best part, once your loan is approved, the funds will be transferred to you the very next business day. The next day. Over 100,000 people have used Upstart to pay off credit cards, student loans, fund weddings, or make a large purchase. You can free yourself from the burden of high interest credit card debt by consolidating everything into one monthly payment with Upstart. Hurry to upstart.com/maccast to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes about 2 minutes, and again, it won't affect your credit. That's upstart.com/maccast, and a big thank you to them for their support of the show. I'd also like to take a moment and thank ExpressVPN. You know, with the recent news about online security breaches, it's hard not to worry about where our data goes. I know it's something that I worry about quite a bit. You know, who's getting my data? Who's watching what we're doing online? Making an online purchase or simply accessing your email? Yeah, that could put your private information at risk. And even beyond using things like public or unsecured Wi-Fi, we hear more and more these days about websites, social media sites, marketing companies, mobile internet and service providers finding more and more ways to track us. Not only that, they can record our browsing history, and they take that and they often sell that to corporations who want to just profit from that information. So a great way to take your privacy back is with ExpressVPN. I've been using it, and it really makes it easy to protect my data and my privacy. It's just literally a quick click of the button. Their app runs seamlessly in the background, and it takes just a click to turn it on. And once enabled, it secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data and also hides your public IP address. And for those times when you are using public Wi-Fi, if you want to keep hackers and spies from snooping in on your data, ExpressVPN is the solution. ExpressVPN is rated the number one service by TechRadar and comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. You can start protecting yourself with ExpressVPN for less than $7 a month. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free by visiting expressvpn.com/maccast. That's expressvpn.com/maccast for 3 months free on a 1 year package. Visit expressvpn.com/maccast to learn more, and a big thank you to them for their support of the podcast. The past couple shows, we have been on the hunt for really cool augmented reality applications, something that goes beyond just being a gimmick. I know there's lots of augmented reality apps in the App Store at this point, but a lot of them, at least that I've found, tend to just do augmented reality almost as an afterthought. It's not really a core part of the application or not something that really adds a lot to the experience. And so we've been looking for and asking the community to send in recommendations of apps that they find actually really useful and that have really cool implementations of augmented reality. And this week is no exception. I received an email from listener James, who wrote in to recommend the application Skyview. This is actually a pretty amazing app. I've owned it for a while, and I agree, James. I totally love this feature inside the app. It's a star watching app. It's a stargazing app. And what it allows you to do is basically hold your phone up, point it at the sky, and you can view for your position, your place on the planet. It uses your GPS and the gyroscopes and other sensors to give you a view of the night sky and help you locate different stars, planets, constellations, other celestial bodies, including in this application, something that I think is cool, satellites, right? All that space junk that's up there flying around. You can see what those things are, and you can get information about them. But what's really cool is Skyview actually does have an augmented reality mode that you can turn on. And so you don't have to just get their visualization of the night sky. You can actually be looking at your actual night sky and then get all the information and overlays right on top of the stars and planets and things that you can see. And it is really cool, and it works pretty well. I've used it a few times, and I actually really like it. It does come in very handy and provides a lot of relevant and useful information. So I think this is the perfect application of augmented reality. Just a few other things about the app, though, because it is so cool. It does have things like a night mode, so you can bias your eyes by the bright light coming from your screen. It puts it in that kind of black and red mode, a feature that I particularly like because of light pollution in your area. You know, you might not be able to see all the stars that the app can actually recommend for you, or constellations or planets. It has a little tuning slider where you can slide it down to sort of match what you're seeing in your sky. So if you're seeing fewer stars, you can kind of pull out some of the more faint stars and only let it show you the bright objects that are in your sky. And I already mentioned that I really do like the satellite feature. So if you want to see, hey, is the International Space Station flying overhead right now? You can actually point your phone up at the sky and see if it's up there. And then in addition, you can just get a lot of information about celestial bodies and planets and stars simply by tapping on them. You can tap on a constellation and get information about that. You can tap on a planet, get all kinds of information about it. Also stars, you know, things like how far away is it? When was it discovered? Who discovered it? All that information is right there at your fingertips. It is a really cool app. And I checked the price on this. I think I paid more for this back in the day, but currently, at least as I'm recording this podcast in the US App Store, SkyView is just $1.99. It is a great value at $2 for anybody who has any kind of interest in astronomy or just likes from time to time looking up at the night sky and knowing what you're looking at. Check out SkyView. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. And thanks, James, for sending that in. I had kind of forgotten that it did have that augmented reality feature. It's been a while since I used the app, but I definitely will be using it again. I typically use it when I'm on my summer vacation when we go camping. It's a great time to use this kind of application, but really, it's great any time of the year. So check it out, SkyView, and thanks, James, for sending in your recommendation. And if you have an augmented reality app that you find particularly useful and you think does a good job implementing the augmented reality feature in a way that adds to the experience, send us your recommendations. Give me an email, maccast@gmail.com. And if you want to do your own audio review, that's great. Do that as well and send that to me directly. Just make sure you keep it kind of brief. Right around 3 minutes seems to be the perfect time frame. And I look forward to receiving those. Another thing we were talking about on the last episode of the MacCast was Apple's trade-in program. We know that Apple is getting a little bit more aggressive about promoting iPhone upgrades, and as part of that, they're offering a lot of you who have older devices the ability to trade in your device, get some credit, get a little discount off your new purchase. And unfortunately, we had Javier write in last week and kind of share a not-so-great experience with the company that Apple uses for doing trade-ins, a company called Phobios. So Apple does not do that themselves. They actually contract and hire out with a third-party company. And Javier ran into a problem where he shipped his device into them, and then they revised his quote basically down to zero, saying that the phone wouldn't turn back on. Well, I have a little follow-up to that, because at the time we recorded last week, Javier had not gotten his phone back. Basically, what happens is when you send it in, they check it over. They make sure it's in the condition that you said it was in when you originally got your quote, your estimate on the trade-in, and then they will adjust that sometimes either up or down depending upon that condition. Well, in Javier's case, they said, hey, it won't turn on. We can't install an operating system on it. So, you know, the $160 we did offer you, we're going to take that away. It's actually zero. And at that point, you do have the ability to reject the trade-in offer and they will send it back to you. He was having a little bit of issue getting it back, but it finally did get back. And once he had it in his hands, guess what? It was functioning normally. He was able to install the operating system on it just fine. It was up and running. He actually sent me some screenshots. So I'm not really sure what happened in this case, although I am starting to feel like Javier, unfortunately, it sounds like you might have been an edge case, because a number of other people wrote in to share their experiences with the Phobios and Apple's trade-in program, and most of them had mostly positive experiences. Some of the stories were mixed, but again, generally positive. I did have one issue with a person who said they kept sending him the wrong kind of box. He was trading in a Mac Mini and they kept sending him a box for a laptop, and he kept trying to explain the Mac Mini's not going to fit in there. It's not going to package up very well. Luckily, he still had his original Mac Mini box, so he just ended up sending it in the original box, and he did get his estimated or quoted amount back. Others did say that, you know, hey, it was no problem. It was great. We had a really great experience, got what they said we would get. And I even had a few people say they got a little bit more. Like once it was received in, they actually revised the estimate up. So it sounds like maybe you were an edge case, Javier. We'll keep asking people in the community for their experiences with the trade-in program. If you do have an experience, good or bad, we do want to hear from you. If you want to send an email or an audio comment, you can send those to maccast@gmail.com. But overall, I do have to say that I think if you are planning on using the program, if there's any way you can do it, you might want to consider getting your trade-in quote, doing the full transaction, like getting the box, sending it in, and I mentioned this on the last episode, and then getting the credit back, doing all of that before you make your new purchase. I know that's not always easy to do. It's not always what people can do. A lot of people, especially if you're upgrading an iPhone, you don't want to be without your phone for any period of time. So, you know, the option to actually get the offer, use that offer, apply it towards your current purchase, and then do all of the transacting after the fact, that's very, very appealing. But if you can avoid that at all, I think that can be helpful because, again, this process is not something that's being managed or handled by Apple directly, so you might be dealing with a third-party company. There could be time delays in terms of getting the box and all that sort of stuff, so it could be a while before you actually get your money. So just take that into account. It's a good thing to know, and I appreciate Javier and all the rest of you sharing your experiences so that we can have a better idea of what to expect. So do really appreciate that. I will share with you one final story. This came from Vincente. He did have a different but similar experience. Not with the trade-in program, but with a battery replacement and a third-party Apple-authorized repair center. He took his iPhone SE, which was having battery issues, to a third-party Apple-authorized repair center for a battery replacement, and they did the service, but when he got the device back, it wasn't functioning as he would have expected. He wasn't getting better battery life, as a matter of fact. It wouldn't hold a charge at all. He'd plug it in, and it couldn't stay powered on for more than a few seconds. The repair center tried to claim that he had somehow damaged it before he brought it in for the battery replacement, that it was not their fault. They weren't going to help him out. They weren't going to do anything for him. And so ultimately, he took the device, took it to an Apple store, and they did their best to try and help him diagnose the issue, try and figure out what was wrong with the phone. In the end, they couldn't figure out exactly what was wrong, but they did suspect that maybe there was improper grounding done during the repair, the battery replacement, and ultimately, they replaced Vincente's phone for free. So he did ultimately get great service from Apple, and I always like hearing about these great AppleCare experiences. It's unfortunately not always become the norm these days, but it feels like maybe things are changing for the better. I am hearing more and more of these positive stories coming from dealing with Apple and their customer service. So what do these two stories kind of have in common? Well, they have this concept of you're taking a device in that you know to be working and functioning, and you are sending it into a service center, to a repair center, to a trade-in center, and when they receive it, they report something different. And you're left wondering, well, what happened? Did something happen in transit? Did some sort of mix-up happening? As a matter of fact, in Javier's case, I am wondering if maybe they just mixed up your device with somebody else's device. Maybe reports got mixed up. I don't know. You know, streams crossed. It seems very weird. You know, the fact that you send it in, they say it's not working. You get it back, it's working perfectly fine. You know, that's a little weird. And in Vincente's case, a little bit different. You send it in for repair, and it comes back worse for wear. You know, how do you account for that? How do you document that? How can you prove your case that, hey, it was working? I don't really know. I mean, I guess take some video, record some things. Maybe that's a way to protect yourself a little bit in these scenarios, but ultimately know that just weird things can happen. And just timing, you know, it may not even be anything nefarious. It could just be a run of bad luck, right? The device is working, you send it in, something happens, maybe it gets jostled around in transit and something comes loose or breaks, or maybe it's just time for that device to go. You know, things happen. So I don't think we can read a lot into this. What we can learn from it is maybe some ways to protect ourselves, to sort of document things, to be a little bit more diligent about what we're doing, and also to not be afraid to get a second opinion. I think that's another lesson from this, right? Take it back to Apple, ask them what you can do, explain your situation open and honestly, and see if they can't help you out. And I think you might be surprised that more often than not, they stand behind the products and they do stand behind their customers and they will help us out. I think, again, that's something that is unique with Apple. I wish it wasn't the case. I think more companies should be like that. And again, it's not always going to be the case, but a lot of times, and in my personal experience, many times, that is what happens. So thanks to everyone for, as always, for sharing your stories. I think it helps the community in general when you can hear what other people's experiences are. So again, I'd like to have more stories about Apple trade-ins, about your experiences with AppleCare and support. And I want to be very clear, too. I don't want to be knocking Apple authorized repair centers. I think these folks are some of the best people in the industry. I know a lot of them personally. We have a great Apple authorized repair center, Apple certified dealer here in San Diego called Crywolf. I've been going to them for years and they're absolutely wonderful. I think they are some of the unsung heroes in our community, and they service a lot of communities that don't have Apple stores or where it's harder to get to an Apple Genius bar. And so I do want to sing their praises as well. Like anything in life, you're going to get different experiences in different places from different companies. Unfortunately, that's just the way it goes. We hear about bad experiences at the Genius Bar. We hear about bad experiences at Apple authorized resellers. But I think most of the time, those are one-off experiences. They're outliers and they are not the norm. So I want to keep things, you know, I want to say overall things I think are still pretty positive in our community. And I still like hearing stories both ways. You know, we want to hear about all the experiences, not just the good ones, not just the bad ones. We just hope that, you know, more often than not, the bad ones are fewer and far between. Last week, we discussed a mystery related to Wi-Fi passwords and where they may or may not be stored on the Mac. Just to refresh your memory, we had a listener who had found that he was automatically connected to his Wi-Fi network even after erasing his Mac's hard drive and booting up to a clean copy of the operating system, specifically to, I believe, the recovery partition of the operating system. And he had stated that he needed to clear the NVRAM before the password would go away. And I was arguing in that episode that I didn't think that passwords, Wi-Fi network passwords, were stored in the non-volatile RAM on the Mac. Although when I did a little bit more research after the fact, there were several posts online that seemed to indicate or claim that they are. I went through sort of the details that Apple has on their support website in the last episode and didn't note that or notice that those passwords were stored in there. At least Apple wasn't indicating that. And so then I started to wonder, you know, are those passwords maybe stored somewhere on the recovery partition? So when you first set up the Mac, I think one of the things that it does ask you to do when you're doing the installation is connect to a wireless network or connect to a network. And maybe when you plug that information in, that's stored somewhere in the preferences on the recovery partition. Did a little research on that and couldn't find any information to indicate that either. Well, the reason I'm bringing this up again on the show this week is that Scott wrote in to point out that maybe the place where the passwords came from was the keychain, specifically the iCloud keychain, which does sync different passwords, including network passwords, for known Wi-Fi networks. So his theory was, well, maybe what happened was, hey, you log, you know, you put a clean version of the operating system on, you reboot, and boom, iCloud keychain syncs, kicks in and syncs that information back over, and voila, you're automatically connected to your known Wi-Fi network with the current credentials. I think it's a great theory. I'm not entirely sure that that's what happened, Scott, at least not in this case, because again, I think he was booting from the recovery partition and was automatically connected to the Wi-Fi network. And at that point, I don't think you're ever asked to enter in your iCloud login or credentials. Now, when you set up a new Mac after clean installing the operating system, that is a piece of information that you're asked for. So I'm with you there. If you've plugged in your iCloud credentials and you were using iCloud Keychain, I can see how that would then bring back your network configuration and information, and boom, you'd be automatically connected. So I think that's very likely the case for a lot of people where it appears, hey, how did this get my network information? And you really don't know. It could be iCloud Keychain. And so I thought another thing worth talking about in this episode was just iCloud Keychain in general, and how can you see what information is in there? How can you maybe do a few things with that? So a couple little tips and tricks here related to iCloud Keychain, starting off with how do you enable or disable iCloud Keychain? Maybe you don't know if it's turned on or not. Well, if you go into System Preferences on your Mac into iCloud, there is a keychain toggle, and you can turn on or off iCloud Keychain. And like I said, if you have iCloud Keychain turned on, what it allows you to do is securely share your passwords, your saved credit card information, your autofill data, all of that's from Safari, all of that stuff across your devices and across your Macs, basically everything that taps into iCloud Keychain. Now, on the Mac itself, where that data and information is synced to and stored is in your keychain, and you can manage that keychain with a utility called Keychain Access. You'll find that in the Applications folder, in the Utilities folder on your Mac, and if you launch that application, you can actually use that to view the current contents of your keychain. So that's going to be things like stored logins, passwords for applications, passwords in general, security certificates, all that sort of stuff. And you can view all that inside the keychain application. So you can just click on the left-hand side and you'll see different categories, or look over on the left-hand side, you'll see different categories. And actually one of those categories is iCloud. So if you want to see specifically what's stored in your iCloud keychain, click on that category and then you'll see the full listing there in the main window. Few other things that you can do with Keychain Access. One of my favorites, and something that I have to use from time to time because I occasionally might forget a password, but because all of your password information is stored in iCloud Keychain, you can actually reveal what the passwords are for any application or website that you might visit if you've saved it to the keychain. So once again, in there, what you're going to do is you're going to select an item from the main list, the item you want to get the password for, double click on it, and that will open up a new window with the details for the keychain record for that item. And in that window, there's a little checkbox that says show password. When you check that box, it's going to prompt you for your Mac's login username and password. If you plug that information in, then it will unlock and display your password right there inside the application. So very, very handy. On iOS, you can also get some of this information, more specifically any passwords that you saved, into Safari. If you go into Settings, Passwords and Accounts, and then click or tap on Website and App Passwords, your saved passwords for Safari and stuff like that are going to be in there, and you can view them from that. I believe you have to authenticate with either Touch ID or Face ID to get access to that. But once you've unlocked it, then it will actually display the passwords right there on your iOS device. So if you've ever forgot a password and you don't want to use the forgot password feature on a website, you can actually just go in and look it up directly either on your Mac or on your iOS device using either of these techniques. Another cool little thing you can do with the Keychain Access program on your Mac is you can actually store secure notes. You can create and save secure notes right within the application. So once again, in Keychain Access, select the Secure Notes category over there on the left, and then click the little plus icon in the user interface to add a new secure note. Then you can give it a name, and you can put anything into the contents field that you want, any kind of text data. So you want to store maybe credit card information, your social security number, just any other sensitive information that you might want to store securely on your Mac. You can use the Secure Notes feature inside Keychain Access to do this. Now, you might be saying to yourself, well, Adam, doesn't the Notes application also have the ability to put a password or securely store a note? And the answer is yes, you can use the Notes application as well. Just secure notes in there, those would sync through the Notes application and not the Keychain. And that might be a little bit better for you because with Keychain Access, there is no way to get at a secure note on your iOS device. So if you want to get at those on your iOS device, you're probably going to want to use the Notes application. So how do you do that? Well, to secure a note in Notes on iOS or your Mac, go into the Notes application. On iOS, you're going to click on the sharing icon. On the Mac, you're going to use the menu, specifically the file menu and the lock note option to lock your note. On iOS, you're going to select the note, you're going to tap the share icon to access the share sheet, and then in the share sheet action, you're going to tap on lock note. And then you will enter a password for your notes. Now, the Notes application just has a single password for all notes, and you can actually access that from the preferences as well if you want to reset or change that. So if you forget the password, you can actually reset it, but just note that any notes that you had already protected with a password, the one that you forgot, will not be accessible. So it's very important when you're securing your notes that you do not forget your notes password. So you might want to put that into another password manager like LastPass or 1Password so you don't forget it. Because again, once you've forgotten it, while you can reset it, you won't be able to use it to access any of your older notes. In that same location, you can also change the password. And in order to set a password originally, you are going to have to validate against your iCloud login. So you'll have to log into or verify your iCloud login to enable and set up the syncing of your secured notes. And one other thing to note related to the secure notes feature is that you cannot secure or sync or lock notes that come from a third-party service like Gmail or Google. So this just works for the native Apple Notes inside the Notes application. Even though you might be able to sync notes from other services, you're not going to be able to protect them. So there you go. A couple of cool little things related to Keychain, Keychain Access, and the Notes application. And then rounding out the episode for this week, I want to do a little follow-up or a little continuation, I guess, of our discussion on the Apple TV and gaming. We recently spoke about the Apple TV as a gaming platform, and I discussed how I felt like it never realized its full possible potential, especially for, I think, more casual gamers. I never expected it to replace, say, like a console or a PC in terms of gaming, but I did expect it to kind of be a supplemental device or a device that appealed to those of us who are maybe a little bit more casual gamers. I know I enjoyed things like Minecraft on the Apple TV. It was fun to play on there. You know, there were a couple of great titles. There's some great games. There still are some great games on the Apple TV, and we even brought up a couple of those on past episodes. And actually, now that I'm thinking about it, if you have a great game that you really enjoy playing specifically on the Apple TV, I'd love to hear about it. Let us know some of your favorites. Shoot us some feedback, a comment, a question, audio comment, a review of your favorite game, maccast@gmail.com. But I had asked you to share some of your thoughts on the Apple TV as a gaming platform. And Dan wrote in and said, really, what I think Apple needs to do is just find the right game. You know, he kind of feels like if Apple just had the right title, that could cement the Apple TV as a gaming platform. And in his opinion, one of those titles could potentially be Fortnite, which is a huge game right now, right? Probably the biggest game, arguably, in the marketplace right now. And there is a version of Fortnite for iOS. You can play it on your iPad or your iPhone. And they just recently added MiFi made for iPhone game controller support to the iOS version, something that people had been wanting for a very long time. So now you can take your iPad with a Bluetooth controller like the Nimbus SteelSeries controller and play Fortnite on it and really create a pretty good gaming experience. The processors, the GPUs, you know, things run very, very well on the iPad, and an Apple TV has exactly the same kinds of technology, the same processors. So why couldn't that be a great gaming experience for specifically something like Fortnite as well? And I am totally with you, Dan. It totally could. And I agree. Having good A-list titles are very important when you're building a gaming platform. Those are the things that can really sell and cement a gaming platform. So definitely that is something, if Apple wants to push Apple TV as a gaming platform, that is definitely something that they would need, these sort of A-list titles in there. The problem Apple seems to have, though, is they do get some of those A-list titles. I mentioned things like Minecraft on the Apple TV, which is now going away. They had the Disney thing. You know, they've had Disney titles. They've had good anchor titles come to the platform. The problem is that Apple seems to often put up too many barriers for developers and sort of frustrates them and gets them to not want to support the platform. I know on the Mac, things like the lack of good built-in high-end GPU support. We've seen them supporting the wrong or competing protocols or sort of trying to force developers into using a specific gaming protocol like OpenGL. General lack of driver support for certain video cards that gamers like to use, right? That becomes a problem. Apple is the gatekeeper there and often will get in fights with or not work with certain developers on things. And that gets frustrating for game developers. The storage limits that Apple imposed on games on the Apple TV, not allowing you to store things locally, but having to pull down content in real time in 125 megabyte chunks. These are all things that make it harder for developers, specifically developers of those big A-list titles, to really want to or get excited about supporting the platform. So I think there's kind of two sides of this equation. Yes, Apple absolutely needs those big A-list titles, but at the same time, the developers need Apple to do the things that they need them to do to make it viable, to make them want to come to the platform. So I think the street goes a little bit both ways. And what I found interesting this week that also made me want to talk about this a little bit is there are now rumors that Apple is considering making a gaming subscription service. Now, granted, this is more like the App Store's version for games of Netflix, right? So you wouldn't have premium game titles that you pay $4.99, $9.99, $19.99, whatever for. The idea here would be just like an app subscription, or more like a Netflix subscription, you pay one price and then you would get access to a whole bunch of games and titles and things like that that you could download, I would presume, to your iOS device and play. But I thought, you know, with all of these other sort of video games as a service kind of things coming into play. So we've been hearing a lot about gaming platforms where you just have a thin client running on a device, on a small set-top box or a little stick that you plug into your TV, and then that connects to some wireless controllers. And then all of the heavy lifting, all of the 3D rendering, and all of the you know, processor kinds of things, the really intensive stuff, though, that happens on a centralized server, right? Something that is built and specifically tuned and set up for that. So you get great gaming performance, and everything is streamed to this little light client, this set-top box. And I was thinking about a gaming subscription service and that sort of model, and it feels like the Apple TV could be a perfect device for that kind of service and that kind of platform. And so part of me wants to think that that is more what Apple is considering, not this idea that I would pay, you know, X dollars per month and get access to a bunch of iOS games, more that I would pay X dollars per month and I would have access to some killer gaming titles, a true gaming platform, a console replacement that I could simply subscribe to. And certainly the Apple TV has the chipsets, it has the graphics processing, it has more than enough power and could be tweaked to support this kind of thing. Is that a business that Apple wants to get into? Not really sure. There's a lot of competition in that space right now. It is growing. It is changing. But if Apple were to ever get in on something like that, it does feel like now is the time, right? They could kind of distinguish themselves, do a great job at building out that kind of experience, and maybe win some market share. I don't think a winner has been set in that space yet. It's not even really clear if that's a space that can be won, if it's something that is going to succeed, but it does feel a little bit like the future to me. You know, why would you spend all this money on a big, heavy gaming console that a lot of people do, you know, several hundreds of dollars for, say, like an Xbox or a Sony PlayStation, when you could pay a monthly fee and not have to like be constantly upgrading your hardware, right? You just always get the best, greatest, and latest games that you can play that perform very, very well. You don't have to mess around with graphics cards and doing upgrades and all that sort of stuff. It seems to take a lot of the complexity out of the equation. And I think Apple TV could be a great platform for that. But I don't know. I'm not a huge gamer. You know, I don't even know if I would subscribe to a service like that. But I have to imagine that there are a lot of you out there who could get excited about that kind of service. And so I'd love to hear from you. What do you think about this idea? Should the Apple TV be a thin client for like an Apple subscription gaming platform as a service kind of thing? And what would that look like? And what do you think about that? So shoot me some feedback. Send me an email. maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with Text Expander for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CashFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you, your comments, your questions. You can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to visit the forum at forum.maccast.com. And finally, if you'd like to follow me on social media between shows, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that will do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.